Hal Herring is at the heart of David Byer's latest documentary called Public Trust. It's a film about public land throughout the country, though Byers focuses on the American West. Herring is a writer and a journalist, not from the West. He grew up in rural North Alabama, but he came this way to hunt and fish and rock climb. And he says in the film, his life as a writer was inspired by his experience on public land. It got deep in his blood.
I had built a life around public land, working in the woods as a forestry contractor on public land. I was an elk hunter, and we had sort of made our life in the West because of public land.
And I would be very selfish if I didn't hope that others could experience the same things that I have with my family on these same lands, and that those lands could be passed on in perpetuity to generations to come.
So my eye-opening moment was a group in Bozeman, Montana called the Political Economy Research Center. There was a guy there named Terry Anderson, and he and two other folks had written a policy paper called How and Why to Privatize Federal Lands.
They had backing from very powerful interests, the Koch brothers, coal, oil and gas. And what Terry Anderson did for me in writing this was to declare once and for all that the American public lands was absolutely in the crosshairs of the wealthiest people in the world as soon as they knew about them.
Hello, this is Hal.
And you follow that, and it just gets wilder and more improbable.
I mean, like I said, I ain't the king of cloud or nothing, but goddamn.
The preponderance of the evidence that I have discovered, there's an enormous, well-heeled movement to take lands away from the American people to make vast sums of money for somebody and change our country forever.
When I read How and Why to Privatize Federal Lands, I realized that this thing that I had found in the West in my 20s, which was the freedom to hunt on public land, was directly in the crosshairs of this movement. And as I delved into it, I realized that this was a huge movement across the West, well-funded, ideologically motivated, and absolutely seriously looking to transform the American West from a huge place where people had the freedom to roam the American landscape to a series of private fiefdoms. And so what I experienced on the ground, both the freedom to roam and hunt and hike and fish and hunt and mountaineer, I saw none of that reflected in this cold white paper that literally laid out how they were going to take away these lands from the American people. It blew my mind.
What do they want, these people who want to privatize public land?
A few different things. One is this moribund ideology that people who share anything in common are debased and ridiculous. The other is more visceral, and it's less ideological. It is simply a massive amount of economic churn, where billions upon billions of dollars go into play, and people make fortunes off of doing nothing more than transferring one piece of ground to another person.
There are people in America who are ready to divest the public lands and enter whatever that uncertain future is. And
all I want people to know is before you enter that uncertain future, let's take a good look at what we have, how we got it, and what's at stake.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Public Trust. It's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film next week, but in the time of COVID-19, this won't be a typical screening. We're going to have to do this online. Invite you all to join us, watch the film, and then stick around to talk about it. We'll give you the details about that here in a moment. This is a story about public land and the effort to privatize it or turn it over to the states. Hal Herring is joining us today, along with the filmmaker David Byers. This is Byers' second film about land in the West. A few years ago, he made a documentary called No Man's Land about the 40-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge by right-wing extremists. Like Hal Herring, Byers also grew up in the South, and he came to better understand what he called the shared estate of public land when he moved west.
I was kind of flabbergasted that you could just go out and like pitch a tent on Bureau of Land Management land, and you know, no one's going to bother you or anything like that. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And that was kind of my unchallenged notion of the whole thing until I kind of came across this protest in southern Utah happening near Blanding at Recapture Canyon. And this was right after the Bundys had had their standoff at Bunkerville. So that happened, I think, in April of 2014. So in May of 2014, the Bundys were kind of on their own road show, and kind of with the assistance of one of the local county commissioners down in southern Utah, they staged this, you know, protest where they drove ATVs across this canyon. And it wasn't that they needed access to anything. It wasn't that it was cutting off access to anything. They just wanted to be able to do it. And then that kind of opened my eyes to this larger world of, you know, anti-public land sentiment in the West. And I think Hal always says, you know, hating the government is kind of like good fun and stuff like that. But then this is where they were kind of getting serious about it. And that opened my eyes, particularly to where, you know, this anti-public land sentiment kind of met this militia movement, which was also anti-federal government. Following that thread is what became No Man's Land when the Bundys took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in 2017. But and me and Hal talked about this a lot because he's, you know, I interviewed him for No Man's Land, but there was a lot there was, that was just a very small slice of this kind of public lands conflict. And it was much larger and much more sinister than a lot of people who felt like they weren't being listened to out in, you know, the high desert of Oregon. And so I thought that there was a bit of a sin of omission in that. And unfortunately, the limited format of documentary, when you have 90 minutes at the outside to tell your story, you have to stay pretty focused. And so it was really nice to be able to kind of open that up and widen that out and kind of explore this topic of public lands from a more macro point of view and what it actually means.
Hal Herring, what do most people think of when they hear the term public land? What do you think the general understanding of that term, that idea, might be?
I think it's very divided by the Mississippi River. We as a country, since I guess like Ronald Reagan, I'm not sure, but we as a country have somehow decided that our federal government is not of the people, by the people, for the people, but some type of enemy. And that's a cultivated, that's been cultivated by those who don't want the obstacles of federal regulation or law. I mean, I have a friend in Oregon one time, he said, the problem with public land is the public has access to it and they ruin it. And I said, that is not my experience. And I have a lot more experience than this guy. And so I think that people have mixed up their anti-federal concept with the abstract, with the very concrete freedoms that we have to roam public land. And between 60 and 63% of all the water available in the arid West is in the snowpack is on public land. And that was not a mistake. That's why Roosevelt and them set that aside. So one of my best friends in Mississippi yesterday took a course at the Boulder Outdoor Survival School when we were 19. And they were in southern Utah. And he said to his instructor, he said, are we in a national park here? Now, we grew up in the South, right? But we were outdoorsmen. And the instructor told him, oh, no, this is all BLM. And my buddy, this conversation was yesterday. My buddy said, I had no more idea what BLM was than the man in the moon. And so people on the east side of Mississippi may have the Bankhead National Forest, the Pisgah, the Nantahala, the Five Fingers, but the concept of public land is totally different. And I think that as a people, we'd better apprise ourselves of what it is that we have as a people, east and west.
The writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams is featured in the film, and she points out that before these were public lands or anything that we would think of as public or not public or anything, they were native lands. David, explain why that's important, because this seems like an important theme in the film.
To understand anything, you need to understand the history of it, and that historical context is important nuance in terms of the conversation moving forward with public lands. To have this acknowledgement that, you know, there were people here before these became public lands, there were people here before they became U.S. or Mexican territories or whatever they were, and to understand that these places have been peopled forever is important to understand before you could make any decisions moving forward, because it's just important cultural context. And notwithstanding the fact that, you know, these public lands do belong to all of us, and it's not just kind of the lycra clad mountain bikers like myself or the hunters like Hal, it belongs to everyone. And there's people who have been there for a long time.
Tell us who Angelo Baca is, those who don't know.
So Angelo is an activist and a filmmaker, a student of history as well. He's from Southern Utah, but he's a person who kind of returned home after studying to kind of advocate for that area, whatever way he could. And he has a lot of different ways of doing that, whether it's through film or through educating, you know, filmmakers like myself or the audiences through our films. That's what he does full time.
Inside Bear's Ears, there's probably like 200,000 different sites. You can't go anywhere in this landscape in any direction without running into something. When I was a kid, I grew up just wandering around in the canyons, hunted with my uncles, exploring all the different ancestral sites. When I'm out there on the landscape, my relatives, my ancestors, they're here. Feel it in my body, feel it in my mind, in my spirit, and they're always with me.
Hal Herring, what does he mean when he says he feels it in his body and spirit? Because this is something that comes up in the film. You say you feel this connection to this land. You say it's deep in your blood.
Well, for me, it's a connection to a place that kind of feeds every part of me. For Angelo and the other Native Americans that we met during the course of this, and through Angelo and his mother as well, they are talking about 12,000 years of inhabitation. And there's so much difference between being a visitor, and I don't like to use the word tourist, because I think that's derogatory. I mean, being a visitor on a landscape and being an inhabitant. And one of the things that Angelo really showed me there was what it is like to inhabit one space for 12,000 years and to feel that resonance of blood. And that's what I think we're talking about. And that doesn't mean that Anglo-Americans, Euro-Americans can't feel that as well. But I definitely defer to someone's opinions about a place who's been there for 12,000 years.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we got here. This is an important part of the film. How we got to this point. Let's get to the 1960s. And one of the things that you reveal in the film and talk about is the general sense of people's connection to the land then. It didn't have this sort of political partisan dimension. It wasn't that way. And this is an interesting moment that I want to play from the film. Actually, this is – we hear the historian Douglas Brinkley, who's also featured throughout the film, talking about the fact that public land protections came as a result of a pretty reckless past, as he describes. You're also going to hear, by the way, Pat Shea, Utah and former BLM head.
in the early 20th century, we were wreaking havoc on the continent. Deforestation, poison waters, unsanitary conditions. In the Dust Bowl, we had environmental disaster. Nothing grew.
Beginning in about 1932-33, people were not happy with the lack of regulation about these lands. And they really began to see the necessity of maintaining and protecting the public lands.
People said, we've got to save what remains of our wilderness. And through the years, every president or politician got measured on what's your record on conservation. I tend to shock people when I ask them, do you know who created the EPA and endangered species and clean air and water?
We can no longer afford to consider air and water common property, free to be abused by anyone without regard to the consequences.
The public in the 60s and 70s demanded that our public lands be protected. They used to say public lands is bipartisan. It's not done belong to a party. It's about Americanism.
Well, if you didn't recognize that voice earlier, that was, of course, Richard Nixon, who gave the country the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. David, what's going on here? Talk a little bit about this moment. And Hal, of course, I want to hear you on this one, too.
For us, it was important to obviously get at the history of public lands and how we got them and how we got to places where we wanted to protect public lands in various ways. And that's actually part of a section that leads up even bigger to like where the friction around public land happened. But we wanted to show that, like, you know, there was a time that, and there still is this kind of concept that the politicians work for the people. And so when the public demands something, then, you know, ostensibly, that's what the politicians are supposed to be doing. And I think that was certainly in the case of Richard Nixon. There was just this moment where, you know, the people held the politicians' feet to the fire to achieve the will of the public.
Well, say more about that and underline that point. And Hal Herring on this point as well, because this seems important, that the public, what you think of as the public, you had to have a record conserving land, at least up until a certain point. And that's what people wanted. That was the will of the people. That seems important to underscore that point.
You know, the public in those days could remember the Dust Bowl, and they could remember, you know, the deforestation and all the environmental catastrophes that came from, you know, either over farming or whatever. But they understood that protecting these places was important because either you're going to destroy them permanently or it's going to take a really long time to get them, you know, back as functioning ecosystems. And they understood that because they had seen the direct consequences of that.
Hal, how do you see it?
I think that the United States of America is one of the most interesting experiments in history. And we occupy kind of not two-faced at all, but we're constantly working with two diametrically opposed ideas about everything. And we're perhaps the best at destroying, as John Lacey said, who's the author, the father of the Antiquities Act. He said, man's ability, proven ability to destroy, creates a necessity to preserve. And Lacey was living at 1909 when we had literally deforested the entire Midwest and it had burned, it was burning and killing people. The Monongahela River was 6 feet deep in the streets of Pittsburgh because they had removed all the timber from the watershed and the rivers were filled with silt that had run down from deforested places all over the East and had destroyed their navigability. So we had seen how you can wreck it. Roosevelt talked about this all the time, Teddy Roosevelt. And they began setting aside these places as watershed protection. That was also driven by this incredible kind of patriotism. It was the Hudson River School traveling around making these beautiful paintings that then traveled the country celebrating the natural landscapes, Yosemite. There was all of this movement, and the American people, although they wanted the benefits of wrecking stuff, they saw the limits as well. And so we began to build this, what called the modern, you know, the conservation movement. But during the 60s, like David said, we had experienced the Dust Bowl. It takes a long time for people to learn anything. I would also like to point out that the 60s were a time of incredible ferment and violence and rioting all over America, and the civil rights movement reaching some type of success in 64. These conservation victories, these wonderful things that we are the beneficiaries of, they can come from times just like the ones we're living in, where it seems impossible to achieve anything, but in fact, the ferment actually produces something wonderful.
Hmm. I want to come back to that. But let me ask you what happens in 1976. Hal, you say in the film there was this evolution that happens, that there's this anger that occurs because now oil and gas starts to get – it's mostly unregulated before. Now all of a sudden this regulation kicks in, and you say this anger turns into what you describe as political theater. Explain what's happening.
Yeah, so what we learned is what my friend Randy Newberg has often said. He said conservation is not convenient. You know, it's not convenient to take time off of doing something else to fix your roof. And I mean, right. And conservation is not convenient. There are winners and losers. And when the United States passed FLIPMA in Congress, all of a sudden, these, say, BLM lands or national forest lands were suddenly subject to all these other desires that people had, which was watershed protection. And maybe you can't graze as many cows because you have now we have the sage grouse issue. So all of a sudden, people started realizing that all these lands around them, which upon which their desires had been priority before, how much timber can we cut, how many cows can we graze, how much copper is there, or bentonite mining, all of a sudden they were now subject to other uses and other priorities. And so the ground was set right there for the conflicts that we've been seeing ever since. And those conflicts were carefully cultivated and brought into the limelight, into the spotlight, by people who were enemies of the federal land policies in the first place, enemies of the idea of public lands. They said, see, they're protecting that sage grouse and chasing you out. How many times have you heard from people who don't really know that we are locked out, I'm making air quotes, locked out of public land? And how many times in my life or your life have you ever experienced being locked out of the BLM lands that you shoot on or ride horses on? I mean, it's never happened to me, but it's a constant universal in this dialogue of the anti-public lands movement.
You talk about, Hal Herring, you talk about the precarious balance to try to strike between industry and the common good. There's that balance there. And one of the things you say in the film is, you say that balance is never going to be fixed. What do you mean?
It's never going to be in one place where you say, aha, we solved it. I mean, there's going to be people who want to take more timber than the National Forest can sustainably produce because they'll make more money doing that. And they'll charge up a local economy for a while doing that, right? You're going to need, like after 9/11, we all agreed that energy independence from the Middle East was really important. And by 2005, we had written EPCA 2005, which was prioritized energy development on public land. So these times are not fixed, right? They're not like nothing stays the same. Exigencies change. The thing is that we could have recognized, and we still can, it's not too late. You can have energy development on public land. You can put the sideboards on it to make sure that all the other resources are not destroyed in the extraction of that energy. And then you can use that energy domestically in the United States of America to boost economies and provide for both the private profit and the common good. That's the balance that it's never going to be fixed, but that's the balance that we need to seek.
I want to ask about, there are various segments throughout the film, and I want to get to a few of those here. Let's talk about Alaska. What did it mean when oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska? And talk about this part. David, you begin here, if you would.
So way back in the day, they found the oil in Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, and Alaskans were suddenly faced with this giant asset and this huge financial windfall. And then the people who were pro-oil very savvily said, well, let's take some of these profits and let's pay everyone who lives in Alaska part of the profits of the oil. And so those people then are directly dependent, financially dependent on this oil.
Yeah.
And those who are electing the people who make the decisions about what happens in Alaska. So
I just want to clarify that fact. There's no income tax in Alaska. They get a dividend check every year.
They do. Yes. Yeah, so yeah, the people of Alaska, and this has become really complicated in recent years, and they started defunding universities because the oil fund is running out. And so there's even more pressure to start drilling in the Arctic Refuge. And a lot of that is, there's people who have been wanting to do that for years, but that's where a lot of this recent pressure comes from as well. And so I can't remember when the Arctic Refuge was enacted, but it was one of those things where people said, you know what, this is one of the most special places in America. We need to really think about it before we start drilling there. And so it was set aside at that point, and they kind of just kicked the decision down the field to study it before they wanted to do it. And it's been kind of this political football, as we say in the film, back and forth ever since. But yeah, a lot of people are directly benefiting from, you know, there being oil exploration and drilling in Alaska, and they're the ones who are voting in the people who. So it was a very savvy move by the people who wanted to open up more and more land to oil production, because the people who were then voting in those decision makers that allow it to happen stand to directly benefit from that.
Yeah, well, as someone puts it in the film, people got really hungry for oil, like a heroin addict needs a new fix. And the new fix started to be the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They turned their sights on that. And it's a really special place. Here's another moment from the film. We'll hear from the historian Douglas Brinkley again and Joel Clement, formerly of the Department of Interior, talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
When you go there, you feel the beginning of creation. What it was like a million years ago on planet Earth. It's our Serengeti. And the sensation of being there just once lives within you eternally.
It's home to the porcupine caribou herd. This remarkable migration that happens every year across thousands of miles. Some of the last best wildlands that we have left on the planet.
And that porcupine caribou herd, that gets us to the story of the Gwich'in people and their connection to it. It's part of their identity. David, tell us about that, if you would.
The Gwich'in people don't exist without the porcupine caribou herd, and I believe the opposite is also true. You know, they have been following the porcupine caribou herd for thousands and thousands of years. And then there was this special place, the coastal plain, where they knew if they went in there and started hunting those porcupine caribou there, that the caribou wouldn't be able to reproduce, and thus their food supply would be dried up. So they followed these animals in a symbiotic relationship for, you know, thousands of years. And so that's kind of what leads us up to our current conflict, and the Gwich'in people taking kind of the lead in trying to protect this area that's sacred to them for spiritual reasons, but also very pragmatic reasons that have been.
One of the representatives of the Gwich'in people is Bernadette Dimintieff, and she plays a powerful role in the film, I have to say. I wanted you to talk a little bit about her, if you would, and the role that she plays, and maybe do it in the context of her, I'll put this in air quotes, relationship with Don Young, longtime congressman up there. There's a moment in the film. Let me play this moment first, because I think it'll set up the conversation. For people who don't know, Don Young is a very polarizing figure, deeply conservative, has been wanting access to ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, for a long time. But there's this really dramatic moment where Don Young is talking about how he doesn't see the Gwich'in people, and you'll hear this in this moment, he doesn't see the Gwich'in people as the people. And one of the things you do in the film is you show this clip to Bernadette of the Gwich'in people. Let me play this moment. This is another clip from the film.
and I was interested to hear about the caribou.
It's not about the environment or the caribou, it's about economics. We need ANWR. And I tell you, Mr. Chairman, I want to believe the people, not the Gwich'in, because they're not the people.
Nothing Don Young says even phases me anymore. He's funded by oil and gas. That's why he's pushing so hard for it. I'm here to say publicly, he's not going to use my people any longer.
Hal Herring, what do you make of Don Young? What he represents in this larger story? Because you have figures like this that are featured in the film. One polarizing figure that comes to mind, of course, is Utah Congressman Rob Bishop. He's featured in being dismissive about the idea of public land in almost every clip that we see, as a matter of fact. Where did figures like Don Young and Rob Bishop fit in this story, I guess?
Rob Bishop of Utah, of course, if you go back with the history of, again, we can't get away from religiosity on the Rob Bishop part of this story and the history of the Latter-day Saints in that country and the Kingdom of Deseret and the conflict that the Latter-day Saints and the Mormons have had since 1857, when we almost went to war. And so the Rob Bishop part of that, there is religiosity. There's a Mormon tradition there of anti-federal feeling. But to tie Don Young and Rob Bishop together is they're representatives of an old paradigm which runs like a river through America and through the world, through humanity. And it's, you know, it's smash and grab capitalism. I don't say that we all participated in it to some extent. I don't say that as that I'm somehow separated from this, but Young and Bishop both represent a time, you could almost call it extractive millennialism. I think my friend Sam Western, he's an economist and writer in Wyoming, coined that term. And it's the belief that you can take whatever you want from the land and waters for about 1,000 years and create prosperity, and then it doesn't matter because your religion shows that is the end times anyway. So there's some of that going on. And then you have to recognize that religious belief or whatever you call it is also very convenient if you want to indulge in smash and grab capitalism. So you're rationalizing your abuse of the natural resources, right? But what I would ask the Don Young, making totally in the economics point, is the petro historian Daniel Yergin. He said, you know, the third greatest unexploited source of energy on Earth is efficiency. And if we spend as much time working on fuel efficiency and other innovations like that, we probably wouldn't need or couldn't afford to drill the 1002 area, the caribou area of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So I find these arguments of these older paradigm, this grab it while you can capitalism paradigm, I find them kind of hollow now, because we understand that we would not have to deface the Mona Lisa to get the plaster behind it if we simply acted in a more innovative and intelligent fashion moving forward, which we're going to have to do anyway.
The writer and journalist Hal Herring, also with us, the filmmaker David Byers. Byers directed the documentary Public Trust, which we're going to be screening online next Wednesday. That's June 24th. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Cars are an important part of everyday life until they break down and just take up space in the driveway. If you can't drive an old vehicle, why not donate it to support KUER? We'll come pick it up for free, and you could receive a tax deduction. It's an easy and convenient way to support the informative, engaging public radio programs that you trust. Learn more about making a vehicle donation at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the latest film in our documentary series. This one is called Public Trust. We're going to be doing an online screening and discussion of the film next Wednesday. We'll give you more details about that here in a moment. One part of the film features this effort by former Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz. Chaffetz wanted to pass a bill that would have sold off 3 million acres of public land. And it's an interesting moment in the film because there was this intense sense of outrage and really a public uprising in the West over the bill. The protests had their own rallying cry, this hashtag, keep it public. Here's the filmmaker, David Byers.
There's this Baba Diom quote that says, in the end, we will only conserve what we love. We will love only what we understand, and we will understand only what we are taught. And kind of the simpler way of saying that is, you know, transparency is the best disinfectant. And so a lot of these things that are happening on public lands, it's death by a thousand cuts. It's a little piece of legislation here. It's another piece of legislation here that either undermines protections on public lands or gets rid of them outright. And that was one of those moments. And what Lan Tawney was able to do with backcountry hunters and anglers was put a big spotlight on that, shine some sunlight on that thing and disinfect the crap out of it. And he did. And there was a big groundswell of anger towards that public official. And I think that's also what we're seeing right now is there's anger towards our public officials in terms of inaction on what we actually want done as a people. And once you get kind of that critical mass to move forward and gain some momentum, then that's how real change is done.
You mentioned Lan Tawney, which is a great name, by the way, for someone who's ahead of the backcountry hunters and anglers. He talks about this reaction, this incredible pushback to this Jason Chaffetz bill. Here's another moment from the film.
And we had rallies in New Mexico. We had a rally in Boise.
Massive turnout this morning with Idahoans from every corner of the state.
Montana.
People from across Montana gathered to advocate for public lands in the state.
Colorado. These were all the biggest public lands rallies they've ever had.
God bless you. God bless Montana and our public lands.
A week later, Mr. Chaffetz on Instagram, wearing camo, and he's holding this dog that does not hunt. Like the dog, I don't even think it's his dog. And he's like, I hear you. And he says, I will not do this anymore. And he uses the hashtag keep it public at the very end of his post. To me, that's one of the silver linings of these pressures that are on our public lands and public waters right now, is it's an awakening of the people. And that's the way things get done in this country. When you're complacent, sure, things are done to you. But when you unite, they have to listen to you.
Hal Herring, what does that tell you? Because it seems like that you had a sense that, gosh, maybe the tide is turning. Maybe we're on the verge of some sort of transformation, and then it doesn't necessarily happen that way. But what do you make of that moment?
I think that with backcountry hunters and anglers, people are starting to recognize what we have, but it may not be enough of us. We're going to have to bring in people who I don't want to try to be of the moment. But we need a much greater diversity of Americans who understand what we have in this asset of the public lands. And that includes all of us, like, you know, of all races, ethnicities, and origins. It's got to be more broad-based even than just what you saw with those rallies. And it's still in the Republican platform to transfer and privatize public lands. I would like to see a day where more conservative, more right-leaning Americans can vote Republican and know that they're not voting for that. I mean, how many Westerners live a lifestyle based on public lands with hunting and camping and having water, irrigation water, would like to vote Republican because of their deep beliefs in conservatism or whatever? I would like to see a day where we have more of a consensus on the value of our public lands. So I don't think we're there yet.
Let's talk about the stakes. It's another thing that Hal Herring in the film lays out. He wants people to understand what the stakes are in this conversation. And this brings us up to the Trump administration and what has happened to regulations and protections over the last 3 years or so. President Trump canceled the moratorium on coal leasing. He canceled the rule to capture methane waste. He canceled a health study on those living in coal regions. Killed the clean power plant. I mean, there's this litany that you lay out in the documentary. And I wanted you to, David, talk a little bit about that, because this seems to convey better than anything else the stakes right now.
Yeah, there's a quote that kicks around the environmental community. You know, with environmentalism, you really can't afford to lose even once. It's because once you lose that space you're trying to protect, or like having clean air and clean water, like they take not very much time to destroy and take a lot of time to recover, you know, or even if they're recoverable at all. Even if we get all these things overturned, you know, we elect a new president or get a new Congress or whatever, we say, hey, let's protect these places. The damage is kind of done, you know, and we have to then engage in either decades, centuries, or millennia of restoration to these places to get them back into as functioning ecosystems. And so to me, that's what the stakes are. I know Hal has an anecdote about the Badger 2 medicine that speaks to this, like, directly about, you know, once these leases are made, even if it's just a lease and there's been no one's even been on the land, those are incredibly hard to undo and are, you know, and it basically can act as a lever of extortion against the American people to get vast amounts of money just to protect something that was ours before these leases were enabled and will continue to be ours. But if someone is getting very rich off of it at the expense of the American taxpayer.
Well, it brings up a point that I wanted to ask you about, because the film seems to make this case that this impulse to want to turn public land over to private interests didn't come from rank and file Americans, didn't come from ranchers or working class folk. That, as you say in the documentary, it was a strategy paid for these big interests. And Hal, I wanted to ask you about a moment where we see you having this conversation with Joel Clement. He was a whistleblower, resigned in protest of what was going on in the Interior Department in the Trump administration. And he's basically taking you through the relationships that he's seeing with people who are in the Trump administration who are basically in charge of land management agencies and their connection to industry. Would you just talk about that?
So what we've had since Ronald Reagan, actually, and you can be more cynical and say that what we've seen under Republican administrations rather than in Democrat administrations, and I find that to be a kind of almost unbelievably absurd that we have to shift back and forth and not agree on certain things, but maybe that's the way it is. I don't know. But Joel put me through a kind of boot camp in connections. And one of the things that ever since Ronald Reagan with James Watt, actually William Parker Pendley, who is acting director of the BLM now, who's a notorious anti-public lands ideologue and anti-environmental regulation ideologue, is he dates all the way back to the Reagan administration. You know, these people, they cycle in and out of political administrations and then back to the private sector where they lobby for oil and gas or mining interests or whatever extractive interest is. And the Trump administration is right now is totally filled with them. Now, to give due, you could say that a person like Secretary Bernhardt, he knows a lot about royalties and public lands energy extraction because he's worked for the energy industry forever. So that's, you know, I understand that that's one way to appoint somebody, but we're appointing one point of view, right? So what you have when you have these open door between industry and government is you have what, if you look up, David Byers actually put me on this idea, the idea of rent seeking, which is to use government, correct me if I'm wrong, David, in order to maximize your profitability in the private sector. That's what's going on. We've come to accept that as normal in America. It's not normal at all. When you're appointed to government service, your idea is to serve at the behest of the common good of the people. I want there to come to a place where the paradigm has changed because people have changed it. And that is that we honor the public lands and our waters and our air as an integral part of our lives, without which no other endeavor is possible. And we get past the Democrats want to preserve the environment or protect it, and the Republicans want to destroy it. I mean, none of that's actually that true. It's just that we need a new paradigm shift. We can't keep playing this political game with the very things that we can't live without.
David, would you talk about this moment that we see Angelo Baca responding to Donald Trump's decision to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument, shrinks it by some 85%. And
yeah,
he's clearly affected by that.
If you know Angelo, you know his connection to the land, you know what it means to have these protections and how the language in the Antiquities Act proclamation creating a national monument around Bears Ears recognizes Native American voices in a way that hasn't been done in the past, and what that meant to those people who had been there for 12,000 years, just as an acknowledgement. And then to see that kind of ripped away from him, but in a moment where any of us would be furious, and him to show such grace in terms of saying, you know, these are the moments that we have to endure. You know, this isn't a moment for hopelessness. This is a moment for endurance, perseverance.
I'm a young person, so I react and I get pretty emotional. But my elders, my leaders, they show me how to be. And they have so much grace. They said, in every generation, in every leadership, in every government, you will always face somebody who represents greed, who represents hatred, who represents discrimination. And we're in this time that we have to survive, and we'll endure it.
I'd like to say, before we leave the Bears Ears, public land management in the future is going to be in companionship and with great input from Native Americans, or it's not going to work. The Bears Ears was a place where five tribes came to the BLM and to the U.S. federal government. And I didn't have any part of it, but people like Angelo and Sean Chapoose of the Utes, the Pueblo tribe, the Zunis, everybody came, the Navajo, came together to create a new model, which was going to be very powerful and effective going forward. So the reduction of the Bears Ears by the Trump administration was a place where I think you can say it was trying to put the boots to a new way, or a slap in the face, an attempt to return to a time where certain Native voices didn't matter. So I do think the Bears Ears reduction was very, very significant.
Hal Herring, let me ask you finally. We are in this moment right now where we are all under quarantine because of a pandemic. We're all watching scenes of anguish from the streets over institutionalized racism. And one of the things you said earlier on the program was that movement, even a movement related to conservation and land, can come from a troubled time. Say something about that, if you would, finally.
I think we can learn from that, and we need to marginalize the voices of the angry, greedy, short-sighted. I go back to like the dreams of the founding fathers, or Teddy Roosevelt, who said that this country cannot work for any of us if it doesn't work for all of us on some level. And I do not think that the protests in the streets and the troubles that we're seeing are separable from the way some of us, a minority of us, want to treat the American lands as an energy colony, for instance, or digging more coal when we already know what the results of that are. I mean, I'm not an ecologist, but I certainly interview them all the time for journalism. And there is no way you pull one strand of anything without moving the net. And we are being called upon now to ask, what do we want our future of the United States of America to be, given the struggles and the incredible successes of the past. I point to that a lot, the public lands, the environment, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. What do we want to be? And I believe that we're going to answer that question in a positive and affirmative sense.
That's the writer and journalist Hal Herring and the filmmaker David Byers. The film is called Public Trust, and we're going to be screening it online next Wednesday. That's June 24th. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.